My name is Ed Senny, and I am from Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana, which is in the northwest corner of Indiana near Chicago. And I have been there for the past 25 years teaching courses in the area of world religions most of the time, although I teach a few courses in basic things in Christian theology as well. But working in things like Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and the religions of the traditional people of Africa, and most recently now my interest has turned to Native American peoples and their spirituality, and I have tried to add some kind of understanding of that to my repertory. Because what I'm really interested is the total human religious response. What human beings have been doing since the beginning in responding to their life situation in ways that we would call religious. That's what I've been interested in. So I do not claim before you that I am an expert on Indian cultures or even anywhere near an expert on Indian religions, but I have been working away at some of those things, and I have been interested in recognizing some of the similarities and some of the exciting differences and so forth. I placed a very brief outline on the chalkboard because if I started going further than that, there wouldn't be enough whiteboard to hold it. The topic tonight, then, is the Yaqui Easter ceremonies. The people that we call the Yaqui are situated today in several different communities in the Tucson area. There is a place called in Tucson called Old Pascua, and that is probably the oldest Arizona community of Yaquis. Then another place within the city, there's a barrio of Yaquis. And then outside, just to the west and south of, mostly to the west of Tucson, there is a place called New Pascua. And that is the village which serves as the tribal headquarters of all the Yaqui people in the United States. And it is there that their tribal officers try to represent them in legal affairs as they seek to help their people. There is another community of Yaquis, however, that is just south of Phoenix and in a place called Guadalupe. And Guadalupe is just at the very south edge of Phoenix. And it is a village that is today made up mostly of Yaquis and a few Maya and a lot of other people that they just call Mexicans that came in too and kind of joined them. And they make some distinctions there that I wouldn't be able to make at a glance. But they know how to make those distinctions. So that's where those folks are. And they have come into Arizona from Mexico. They came into Mexico starting about 1887, migrating in small groups. Families would come up into Arizona as they were seeking for some kind of freedom to live their life. For they had just been engaged prior to that in a conflict with the government of their area, which was really this a Spanish kind of domination. They had been in conflict with them and had lost that struggle for independence. They wanted independent rule over their own traditional territories. So many of them were killed actually in those wars, but some of the survivors decided to move northward out of their home region, difficult as it is to leave one's land, which is leaving one's mother. They did it anyway. And when they first moved up into Arizona, they were afraid to practice their traditional religious ceremonies, because as that had been forbidden in the South, in Mexico, they had pretty good reason to believe that it would be forbidden here too. But about 1909, a few of the families in Old Pascua very carefully began to reintroduce a set of ceremonies that had been for them one of the very most important sets of ceremonies in their life for several hundred years now. And so in 1909, they began to revise these ceremonies. Now, still with that little history, before they came into Arizona from Mexico, they had been converted to Christianity starting about 1617. In the year 1617, the Yaquis invited some Jesuit missionaries to come and live among them. Already at that time, my sources suggest that they were making a distinction between the Spanish rule over their country and the missionaries. For the Spanish rule, they saw as destructive, something to be resisted, but they seemed to feel favorable toward the Jesuit missionaries and invited them to come and live among them. In a period of only 6 years, we have record of 30,000 people being baptized. 30,000 Yaquis baptized in those first 6 years. As there were never more than five or six Jesuit missionaries living among these people. So they were, I suppose by our standards, they would be amazingly successful, if having a lot of baptism is a mark of success. During that time, that early part of their stay there, the Jesuit stay there, probably in the first 10 to 15 years, the way of life of the Yaquis changed. They had been living in little rancherias, just little a little family living here in the countryside, and over a couple little hills and kind of out of sight of this one is another little family living, and still out of the way there another one, just sort of dotting around, and they were connected to each other in various ways that they understood and worked out well for them. But these scattered little rancherias is what they get called. And before very long, after the Jesuits had come, they had been persuaded to move in along the Yaqui River, and there they began to be situated in eight towns. So they come in out of the countryside and start settling down in towns, a lineup of towns, eight towns down the riverside. And there, as they move from the countryside into town, they learn quite a different type of life. In the middle of each one of these towns is the church. And they had never seen buildings like that before. They're taller than anything they had ever found it necessary to build. They had just been kind of blending their little huts into the countryside as much as possible. Now you come to pretty nice churches, pretty good size, some of them. And they were right in the center of the town. To make a town like that, you have to clear all the brush out of the way. It's desert country, but that doesn't mean nothing grows there. There are all kinds of shrubs and grasses that grow there, but they would clear a place in front of the church, a large area in front of the church, which then was the church plaza. And it was there that a lot of ceremonial dances would continue to be held. And those ceremonial dances on the plazas in front of the church consecrated that space, made it holier and holier all the time. Now, actually, the Jesuits didn't do their work one-on-one with all the Yaqui people, but they managed to enlist a small corps of Yaqui leaders to do the teaching and the administration of a whole new style of agriculture. These people had been used to supporting themselves with just a little subsistence farming, just enough to get by, and some hunting and gathering. But now they come into some pretty fancy farming, going to do it like they did it in the old country, Spain. So the Jesuits taught them a new way of doing agriculture. So you have your little village, and then you have the management of all the lands around the village being farmed. And that's the way in which the Jesuits moved them from their former life into this town life. Now, I suppose that's enough of a lead-in to start talking about their old world view and their new world view, which I call two worlds and two kinds of power, and I refer to two kinds of spiritual powers is really what that refers to. The first world we will call the forest world. That is the world of their previous existence. The life that they lived then was saw them as human beings sort of fitting in, blending in with the rest of the natural environment. There was no hint in the way they set themselves up that they were going to stand tall over the rest of nature and take it over and dominate it, but rather to blend in with it like the rest of the animal kingdom does. It participates in that world of nature. So they did. That's the forest world, untamed, unhumanized, left to be what it was in its natural state. Their sources of food were, I guess I've already hinted, from farming and some from hunting and gathering. Their spiritual powers, that will be what we're kind of interested in tonight. Their spiritual powers are, some of them, from animals. So it is felt that there is a power of the deer, a spiritual force behind that physical presence, a spiritual force of the deer. Sometimes it seems as though it's a kind of master of all the deer, a spiritual presence that in some way is present in all the deer, but is more than the deer at the same time, a kind of deity of the deer. There are powers like that that they seem to address. The same goes for the plant world, spiritual powers associated with the certain aspects of the plant world. And then also with the landscape itself. In certain mountain areas, there are thought to be powers that live at the top and certain powers that live in some of the more mysterious aspects around the mountains. And a typical thing that I suppose a lot of anthropologists around the world have wanted to call animism, you know, when you have spirits, living personal spirits all over the place. I don't like the term very much because it lumps too many nice things together and gets rid of them by naming them animals. But it is that notion that there is a spiritual presence in all of these things, and that these spiritual presences can confront us and can address us, can favor us, can punish us, can reveal things to us. And so they seem to have felt that especially in dreams and visions, these kinds of powers might appear to a person. And when they did, sometimes that led them to a special kind of obligation toward that spirit. So if the spirit of deer appeared to me in a certain kind of dream, and the dream took on a certain kind of structure, it would become clear to me, perhaps through a spiritual advisor, that I now, from now on in my life, have a special kind of obligation to this deer spirit and to the deer, to the physical phenomena of the deer around me. So different spirits would connect themselves with people, and people would live out certain kinds of obligations and sometimes vows. They would come out of that vision experience or dream experience to make a vow to serve that kind of spirit for the rest of their life. Then there was another set of spirits that were important to them, which I will simply call the ancestor immortals, or the immortal ancestors. Now, the story behind that, calling a group of spirits immortal ancestors, goes back to the story of a talking tree. Once there was a tree, and it kept talking, and nobody could understand what it was saying. Sometimes it's called the vibrating tree, since that's what talking is all about, is vibrating. And finally, a girl came who was pure and innocent and was able to understand the spirit that spoke through that tree. And the message was that there are coming some people with white skins, and they are going to teach you a message. And after that message, some of you are going to get baptized. And those of you who are going to get baptized will find out that you'll get all kinds of benefits from that, but then you will die. You will become mortal. But those who refuse to receive the baptism will become immortal, immortal spirits. And so it happened that when the missionaries came, some were baptized. They learned the religion of Christianity. And when they died, they expected something good to happen. They would go to paradise sometime. And in the meanwhile, those who had refused to accept the baptism, they became immortal spirits wandering about in the forest. And they're still there, the ones who lived at that time and became those spirits. So through the ages then, even as the living Yaqui community, you could say, was converted to Christianity, those back from the beginning of that missionary time who did not become, they became the immortals. And they still speak to the living Yaquis through dreams and visions at times. And they still provide a certain kind of power. Now you see, the power of the animal realm, the plant realm, and even the powers now of these immortals, it belongs to that world, doesn't it? That forest world, that wild, untamed kind of world. But they've never forgotten those powers. When they converted to Christianity and they began to live in a town world, they got some new powers. They got in touch with some new powers. These were powers like Jesus, or they will, you can just list them in a simple way, we won't be theological. God, Jesus, the Blessed Virgin Mary, and some of the saints. These were experienced by them as some spiritual powers. And they became available to the life of the Yaquis through statues. They had a lot of statues. Remember, this is kind of the Spanish Catholic influence down there. The statues that were sitting on the altar and were carried in processions and were felt to be very much the presence of that spiritual thing, person, which they represented. Images, I think, for religious people, images are never just a reminder of something that's absent or far away, but somehow that which they point to is present within them and beyond them at the same time. And so it is felt in this kind of religious image worship or reverence for images. It is felt that it through the concrete presence of that piece of clay or wood consecrated as it is for this purpose, we can get in touch with that power which is present in it and is at the same time beyond it. And so they felt like the powers the town powers, the new powers that they had learned, were available to them through images and through a whole set of ceremonials that they learned from the Jesuits. So the particular plays and dramas that the Jesuits taught them, the liturgies that they learned, the formal prayers that they learned, those were the ways in which the new spiritual powers were mediated to them. So they live in the two worlds, the forest world and in the town world. The benefits, I should add, the benefits that they receive in this town world and from its spiritual powers are strength for life in this world, comfort in times of sorrow, healing power. By the way, they also were very much in the healing powers that come from the animal realm and the plant realm too. And finally, grace to go to heaven after they die. So those are some of the benefits that they expected. Now there's a sense in which the Yaquis, who are hanging on to their feelings and some of their practices about the forest world and its powers, at the same time hanging on to this new thing they have learned, the Christian powers and ceremonies, are struggling to put these together. And for about 150 years, Jesuits worked with the Yaquis. And it's not clear, but Jesuits have had a bit of a reputation for looking the other way when they were doing missionary work and the people, the native people, were kind of putting it together their own way. Wisely they looked the other way, like parents wisely look the other way sometimes when certain things are getting put together by their children in creative new ways. Maybe some of that. But after 150 years of being with them, some bad things happened and the Yaquis drove out the last of the Jesuit missionaries, and for the next 150 years they lived there in Sonora, in Mexico, without any missionaries among them, but this Christianity which had been planted there by the Jesuits continued to grow and develop in new, and I think I would say, creative ways. And so what I'm about to talk about, the Easter ceremonies, is, I think, a reasonably successful effort on their part to bring these two worlds of the psyche together, these two worlds of the heart together, that forest world and that town world, that pre-Christian religiousness and the Christian, to put these together and give expression to them. And in a sense, by doing ceremonies that bring these together, I believe that they reconcile the two again and again and again. There's a tension between these worlds that never completely goes away. It builds up, and they deliberately build up the tension at time and then resolve it through certain ceremonies so that the two can live together within their hearts and the benefits of both can be theirs. So we turn to their most famous single festival cycle, which we call the Easter cycle, the Wema, they call it, or Weema. It actually starts on Ash Wednesday and goes to Easter Day. The highlights along the way from Ash Wednesday until Easter now will be the Friday nights of Lent in Guadalupe. And I think that's true of also of the Tucson communities, the Friday nights in Lent. And then come the powerful days of Holy Week, when all sorts of things get dramatized. The focus of their ceremonies, about 35 to 40 different ceremonies between Ash Wednesday and Easter, the focus seems to be the gathering up of some evil powers who seek to find Jesus and to capture him and to defeat him. But finally, as the drama unfolds, he is victorious over such powers. And all of this they will be dramatizing. I see the two worlds, both forest and town world, at work in this. By doing this ceremony annually, they assure the well-being of their community for another year. They don't do it and invite everybody to have some nice personal, individualistic, religious success with this, but they believe that by doing this ceremony as a community, we do it for the community, and the community shall live again in the grace that comes through this risen Christ. A very communal notion of the benefits that this set of ceremonies will have. It is also a time for making and fulfilling personal vows. If you were sick, it is common among the Yaquis, if you get badly sick, that either you, or if you don't, your mother might do it for you, will say to the Blessed Virgin, if I get well, I will serve you in 10 years, successive years of the ceremonial, Easter ceremonial, or something like that, taking vows to perform certain services. All right, and finally, there are more than a few hints in this that the ceremonies themselves renew the world, bring about a renewal of the physical environment as well. Paul, will you please put that on now? The physical setting in Guadalupe. First, perhaps I should indicate that I knew a little bit, very little about these folks until I went down to live in Tempe for 6 months in the spring of 1984, went there about January, and had heard a few things about these people, but not much, and then I discovered that they were only 3.5 miles from the apartment I was living in. And so little by little, I kept learning more about them just in time so that I could start running down there on some of the Friday nights of Lent. And I was able then to go to the plaza of the Yaqui church quite a few times in Lent, and an awful lot of time I spent down there in Holy Week. And that's the background of my comments. My comments and interpretations come then both from that experience and from then reading about the culture and the ceremonials of these people. And I have tried to give it my description of it. I tried to be true to what I saw and what I'm pretty sure was going on there. And there are some differences between this group and the way they do it and the groups down in Tucson and the way they do it. In fact, the groups in Guadalupe are condescending toward the people in Tucson, because they think that the people in Tucson have allowed far too many photographers and anthropologists and other evil beings to come in among them and to desecrate their holy ceremonies. So here in Guadalupe, I discovered this, after this big main street here, then you have these two little dirt streets, and this one as well. And we're just really right under Highway 10, Interstate 10 practically here. And then you have this great barren, not a plant on it, plaza, which is, this is like a huge block with these two churches sitting here with houses right behind them, and then across the street on all sides. You may wonder, what's a Roman Catholic church doing and a Yaqui church doing side by side? Well, the story about that is that they were Roman Catholics when they came and settled here, and they were Yaquis too. And they built that church that's now called Roman Catholic Church, and it was just what they needed. It had the spires and the crosses, and it also had a dirt floor. And it had a movable table that served as an altar back there, and you could set all the images of all the saints and gods on that. And they had their ceremonies and they did their dancing, their ceremonial marches and dances on that nice dirt floor. Well, when enough Mexicans moved up into the community, this is the way the Yaquis tell me, when all those Mexicans moved up into the community, they said, well, can we use your church? Answer, of course you can use our church. So before we knew it, they had taken over our church and they poured a big cement floor in it. And before we knew it, they got a whole bunch of these long benches in it, and they anchored them down into that cement. Now, who can dance and stuff like that? So we said, oh, take the church. You can have it. We built another. So they built a little Yaqui church right next to it. Now, remember, they belong to this church. They're Christians. They celebrate the liturgies through the year. But there are times in the year when that just won't cut it. They've got to do the thing which is theirs and which combines the Christian and the Yaqui world. And that's what this church is for. And it's got a dirt floor. And it's got a big table across the back there. And it's got props hanging all over the walls and plaster falling down. Not too persnickety about some of those details. But it's their place. And in front of it, then, you have this great plaza area. Very prominent here, maybe 30 yards or so in front of the building, is what is called simply the church cross. And then there are the stations of the cross around, just across the street, in front of people's front yards. Okay, they all belong here anyway. And so they put up these crosses at the beginning of this ceremonial cycle in Ash Wednesday. And boy, I mean to tell you, they go around that thing lots of times between Ash Wednesday and Easter. And you better carry knee pads with you, because there's gravel that you have to kneel on a good share of the time. And there's an awful lot of that at each one of the stations of the cross. Now, that's the physical setting that we have. The Yaquis then divide themselves into a whole set of ceremonial societies. They organize themselves. There's one large society called the Pharisees. Remember, this is going to be Pharisaeus. This is going to be the battle of the powers of evil against Jesus, trying to capture him. And so the Pharisees are divided up then into groups like a military. They're the caballeros, that'd be your cavalry in the military. It's a military organization. And then you have the Roman soldiers as an infantry group. And there are all kinds of officers within that. There are persons designated as the Pilatos. Guess what that is? The pilots. You don't have one pilot. You got a bunch of pilots. Let's see. Well, that'll do it for now. Roman soldiers, pilots, captains. And, of course, they have a drummer, and they have a flutist, and so forth. Then there's another group, also part of this larger Pharisee group, and it's called the Chapayecas. And Paul, if you would like to exchange this for that, that would help us. The Chapayecas. Spell it for a sec. The Chapayeca. Crazy people, aren't they? They are costumed dancers, masked dancers, who wear, well, let's say, they wear these big masks, and the masks come in different types, but this is sort of the classical one, the long pointed nose, the animal-like almost ears sticking out, horns sticking out, so you feel like you're dealing with an animal, the animal realm here a little bit, and these masks are sometimes that big, sitting up here, so that the eye holes, if there are any, maybe there'll be one in there that they can peek out of, would be down in here someplace. You're adding about a foot of height to the physical presence here. And they'll wrap themselves with either great big blankets, and then ropes, and belts of that kind, or even big overcoats. It's hot. It's hot. And then that belt you see around here is made up of probably 80 to 100 deer hoofs, dried deer hoofs. Now they whisper after they've said that, we can't get hold of deer hoofs very well anymore in our new life, so we use pig hoofs.
But they work the same. They're dry and they clatter when they hang together and make it shake themselves like that. And these rattle belts make all that noise. And they have them on their ankles as well. They carry a long wooden sword painted red and white. And they carry a knife in the other hand. There's something warrior about this. Something also is like a hunter about this. For they'll use that long one going around poking in the sand like they were looking for tracks, as though they were tracking an animal or tracking Jesus. Try to find him during some of these ceremonials. As they march along with all the others, they will clap those sticks together, the long one and the short one, and beat a rhythm that you get going there. I'm just telling you the societies. Now that's one group. Then almost, I guess, on the other side of things, there is the church societies. And there you have the teaching leaders, the maestros. They are the prayer leaders. You have cantoras, a little group of singers, three or four old ladies and a couple little girls together. No boys singing, no men singing in that, just a couple of them. And then you have sacristans who have to take care of all the images and dressing them and undressing them and changing all kinds of things around there. You have altar women, you have little girl flag bearers, you have little angel girls, you have special privileged people who bear the image of Mary in some of the processions. And finally, you even have one person whose privilege it is to carry about a 15-foot pole, and up at the top is just this little bitty banner that has the sheep and the cross, the Lamb of God. And they call that Anima Christi, the soul of Christ. And no matter how bad things get in this drama, as far as the evil powers beginning to overcome the powers of good, they always remember that way up above it all is the Anima Christi who leads us forward in safety. And he will be victorious. You can't defeat the soul of Christ. Then there's two more groups. There is a group called Matachinas, which is a very colorful dancing group that represents the old yucky way of life. And they only come on at joyful times. You won't see anything of them when there's conflict out here. But only when the conflict is resolved, there's a dancing and singing of the Matachinas. And then there are the fiesta dancers. Here we have the Pascolas. Paul, can you help me? The Pascola dancers, I just have the masks there for them. They represent these immortals back in the woods. And they represent also, at the same time, the spiritual power of the mountain sheep. So when they're in the middle of this ceremony at various times, they are nonetheless bringing that forest presence into this town ceremony. And we won't look at that one long because we want to get right on to the deer dancer, which is another one of the spiritual presences in this ceremony, fiesta dancers. Deer dancer comes on and does and dances in moments of celebration in these church ceremonies, but never goes inside of the church, never inside, but always outside. Deer on his head. I watched these mule deer while I was running this stuff through again tonight, and some deer were out back of the house, and I was watching. Now when they dance, they do that, and all of a sudden you realize you're not paying any attention to anything except the deer, and pretty soon you know you're confronting deer. You're not confronting the dancer, but deer. The power of the forest presence is very beautifully presented in their dances, accompanied by their own rattles and cocoon shells and the things around their waist. And they'll also have a little group of three singers with them. That's the setup. Ash Wednesday.
do your service of ashes like usual in the early evening. And while they do it in the Yaqui church, and while they're doing that, the Pharisees, the Pharisees will begin to march outside. They will put themselves in rows, military rows. Hitting that dust, and the dust starts right. It's kind of a militant, angry step, and they're out there. So they take their postures in front of the church, and when that Ash service is over on Ash Wednesday, people come out, here it is. It's like the gauntlet is cast. The beginning of the ceremony has happened. From now on, every Friday night, there's going to be a little bit more drama added to this. After they have their little service of prayer, there will be all this marching. So on the first Friday night of Lent, while they are, the pious people are in there on that dirt floor, sitting around on the floor, and the people kneeling up around the altar, and the maestro is reading these prayers, and the cantoras are now and then chanting a little song or something. And all of a sudden you start hearing this rustling under the altar. There's noise and fuss going under the altar. Ignore it. Keep on praying, keep on praying. Pretty soon something wriggles out from under the altar. You hear this coyote sound from under the altar. And pretty soon here comes a chapayeka. He's coming in out of the forest world, out of the wild world. You hear that coyote sound. Comes up, shakes himself off like he's been sleeping for 20 years. He has for a year. And looks over the maestro's back to see what's this praying about. You know. And every time the prayers say the name of Jesus or will say the name of Mary, he shakes himself like he's got to shake some contamination off. Those names are power. And they are, apparently at this stage of the ceremony, they are antithetical powers. They are powers that oppose his power. And so the conflict is being set up. Well, every night then, every Friday night in Lent, you have more chapayecas showing up. They come in out of the fields and come rolling over the fences, and they come stumbling into the plaza like they just came out of another world, which they did. And of course, you know who they are. They are the brothers and the uncles and the cousins of the rest of the Yaquis. But everybody acts like they are from another world. Nobody knows who they are. They are anonymous. From the time this ceremony starts till Easter, they must be anonymous, and every effort is made to keep it that way. Now as you get into the Holy Week, you have on Palm Sunday night, you have some processions, a blessing of palms and so forth, and then you have a fiesta, you're going to have a celebration, and you have it out here between those two churches. You want to slip this one in there now? Where they build a ramada between these churches, and they have a procession out of the Yaqui church and around the cross and over into here, where they have now built a ramada, which is nothing but an open shed, a shed that's open on one side. And they have a couple poles in the middle of it that clearly divide it into two halves. And in the one half, they set up a box, put a white cloth on it, put an image on it. And then that's where the church people sit and pray then as the night goes on. And the other side, a couple musicians sit around in that little area. And here come the Pascola dancers. Here come the deer dancer. And they dance on that side, right side by side then. And in this little areas, you have church people praying, the fiesta people dancing, the town world and the forest world, side by side, but not really intermixed yet. And you have all the rest of the people milling around out here with a couple of mesquite fires to keep a little warm, going home every once in a while to put the babies to bed or to have a beer or something and then come back and be watching and in a certain sense participating in what has to be done out here. And then on Palm Sunday, they have more procession with palms and things like that. Really gets rolling good on Wednesday night with the candelabra service. It's the tenebrae service. And that night they build a whole lot of cottonwood trees inside the Yaqui church and just bring the forest in. They just put up a forest in the church. And then they line up out in front there, and while the maestro and a few other people do their pious work of praying right here, they're all lined up in their military formation out here, and two by two, these chapayecas, these strange creatures from another world, go inside the church, push around in the greens like they're looking for something. They're looking for Jesus to capture him. And they come out and pantomime their report to the captain. And things like that. And then when that's all done, then we begin to have the extinguishing of the candles in the tenebrae service. And when they get it down to the last prayer and the last, these things go on for 4, 5, 6 hours. It gets along toward midnight, and the last candle is carried out, and then starts the whipping. And they have a ritual whipping ceremony where it begins with one person taking a small whip, another person getting down on knees this way and accepting 3 strokes on the back. After each stroke, the very whip makes the sign of the cross on that person's back, and then that person gets up and till everybody, the chapayecas, the pilatos, everybody has gone through this, unless they don't want to. I mean, the villagers may or may not, but most of them do, I think. And it's a time of remembering Christ's scourging. See, they don't beat people up. I don't mean that. They don't beat people up. But it's a ritual whipping to remind us of Christ's scourging, to remind us of the importance also of our accepting punishment for our wrongs, a time also of cleansing and pardon. So it is that sort of service on Wednesday night, the ritual whipping. Thursday noon, you have some very interesting things about the pursuit of an old man who is really representative of Jesus. Folks, I fully recognize what's happened, and you can see it on my face what's happened. I can't finish this. I can't even get the punchlines through to you in the time that remains. I'm very, very tempted to say that instead of starting with sand paintings and Kachina dolls tomorrow at 10:45, if you want to kind of hear how this turns out. That's terrible. But well, I could do that. I could finish that and then maybe still say a few of the basic things I wanted to say about what sand paintings really are and what Kachinas really are. But maybe with the 3 or 4 minutes that we could talk right now, and based on what I've already said, maybe you'd like to make some observations or ask some questions or something like that. Yes?
It just seems that people worry so much about how you can make and bring the spiritual world of Christianity and the Indian world and their spirituality together. It's wonderful to see how they've just gone ahead and wed the two for their own, for themselves. And it's an interesting model to think about, and being to use things that are important and still feel a part of a regular Christianity.
One of the standard judgments that's been made again about South American Christianity, Central American Christianity, and about this kind of thing, is that it's basically paganism with a veneer of Christianity over the top. I'm not enough of authority to absolutely reject that, but I'm very skeptical of that. I think these people, as near as I could talk, the ones I've talked to and so forth, I think they were genuinely Christian, and they were genuinely Yaqui, and that means they still had those other powers at work for them. And so I don't accept that it's just going through Christian motions over a pagan layer. I think there is a more creative syncretism there than we often think. And theologians have to try to evaluate whether that's all bad or all good, or whether it's, well, how should they evaluate? I don't know. But I think it's a creative bringing together of these for a meaning, an attempt to create a meaningful thing. Yes?
Do the Matutinas wear largely black? I'm trying to remember who those people were.
No, there were lots. The Matutinas, no. The Pilatos wear a black black robe, black flat hat.
Yeah, it's like black pants and a black shirt.
Yeah, and on Holy Saturday when they march,
that's what I'm talking about.
Then they even wear a black veil. The Pilatos and the Caballeros all wear that on that day.
Yeah, I've only seen the Saturday, and then I'm trying to remember they would have a cross around their neck, and then they would hold it in their mouth, and then
okay.
The
Chapayecas, according to the Guadalupe people, the Chapayecas, when they put that mask on, that big mask from the forest world, they also put a rosary in their mouth, and they are obligated to be praying all the time while they're doing all these other things, so that the negative power that they are Antichrist power that they are manifesting in their portrayal here, that this power does not work against them. They defend themselves with the rosary and a constant prayer there. So it clearly is a kind of opposition and protection at that stage, all of which I think that's a good reminder on that. Well, if you want to hear how that goes, we will pick it up at 10:45 tomorrow.